You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 72, Fake News.
Hi, today we are talking to Gordon Pennycook, and we're going to talk about things that aren't true and how people deal with them. Things like fake news and disinformation. Just to start off, Gordon, I remember reading in Steven Pinker's book on rationality. He was saying that the political impact of fake news is kind of slight, and it only, quote, titillates a faction of partisans rather than swaying a mass of the undecideds. In your 2021 paper, you found people tend to believe fake news when it matches their political views that they already have. So how do you see the dangers of fake news?
So to some extent, Pinker's right, because people are actually better at distinguishing between like true and false news than we give them credit for. Now, it is the case that people believe things more when they're consistent with their ideology. So like when we have a bunch of experiments where we have like the way we do these studies is we have a set of news headlines that are we use a pretest to select whether they're like pro-democratic or pro-republican, and then they're equally pro-democratic and equally pro-republican, just on opposite sides. And then we give people these kinds of headlines, and we ask them to like indicate whether they believe them or whether they would share them, and they make judgments about the headlines. And what you find, of course, is that Democrats believe the pro-democratic headlines more, Republicans believe the pro-republican headlines more. The difference isn't as big as you might expect, but it's still there. But what you also find is that people who are more deliberative believe the headlines, the false headlines less, and the true headlines in some cases more. When it comes to partisanship, people believe the pro-Republican headlines more regardless of whether they're true or false. And in fact, the effect is larger for true headlines than they are with false headlines. So if anything, like political consistency is associated with accuracy. And part of the reason why, you know, you find this effect is that it's just a kind of feature of familiarity. People believe things that are consistent with what they've like seen before.
Right.
And so it just kind of comes out that if you're living in different information environments, you watch different news stations, whatever, you're going to have different sets of beliefs. But it's more about kind of exposure than it is about partisanship. And if you want to understand why, like, what helps people distinguish between what's true and false, you have to know more about, like, how they think, like whether they are engaging in deliberation, whether they're questioning their intuitions, and whether they're engaging with high quality news sources, essentially.
Right, right. One of the things that people are concerned about with fake things is that they spread. People, like they couldn't 30 years ago, can repost things and share them. And there's been some analysis suggesting that some of these have the same qualities as urban legends and other sticky things. What can we say about the kind of misinformation that tends to spread around and become a problem?
Yeah, it's an important point. Also, like the whole idea that, you know, everyone's talking about misinformation, they talk about fake news after the 2016, you know, U.S. presidential election, but this is a very old phenomena, you know, and so there are certain types of narratives that constantly pop up, and these are the ones that people find kind of intrinsically interesting. I mean, conspiracies kind of fit into that milieu, because people are really fascinated by this idea that there's like secret powers that are influencing things, and like it's just really compelling. But the other thing that is important is that one kind of different element for, you know, let's say the modern issues that we're having has to do with like the kind of speed of transmission and access to information. And so one element of like a new kind of urban legends is that they kind of emerge rapidly following some sort of event. So like, you know, Russia invading Ukraine, you end up with, there's a kind of like information gap for people that know what's going on, and it's just filled with stuff. Like they're basically like rapidly emerging urban legends, and then some things stick and some things don't, but that's the kind of novelty these days that we're trying to tackle with the research.
Yeah, things like violent stuff and emotional stuff that gets you emotionally driven and excited, I think spreads pretty quickly in, you know, all kinds of different things, conspiracy theories and fake news and everything like that.
Yeah, what one way to think about it is, so I mean, social media in particular is an attention economy. Like if you want to you know, if you want to like produce some sort of content that goes viral or that people see, there's two elements of it. What you think about, then this is from a colleague of mine, Zivi Epstein, but he calls it the try versus buy idea. First thing you have to do is get people's attention. And so a key element to that is like, is it emotional? Does it seem important? And that's then, so people who create fake news use really sensationalist things to kind of grab attention. Mm-hmm. But then people have to click on it, you know? And so like, there has to be something about it that's compelling. And those are sometimes different things. And so we have a recent experiment showing that like emotional language, you know, like using words like disgusting, that grabs people's attention. It makes them kind of spend more time looking at content in like a simulated newsfeed. But actually they believe it less.
Oh, okay.
So it has different effects on what people like, what draws their attention and what they believe, because it like people are kind of grown to become dubious of things that are described in such flamboyant language. So these dynamics are pretty interesting to disentangle.
Yeah, that's really good. I've noticed over the course of the last couple decades that headlines have changed, because in a newspaper, there's no click through. So, you know, now they can't give away what's in the articles. They say, oh, you won't believe what this person said, but you have to click through to find out, and often scroll through lots of ads to figure out what the point was.
Yeah, to get to the tidbit. Yeah, exactly. Which is hardly ever as interesting as it sounds. Yeah.
Yeah. But even on TV, though, I remember seeing like, oh, was there a UFO spotted over Atlanta? And then you watch the news later and like, no.
It wasn't. The answer is no.
So are you even interested in people's critical thinking ability with respect to this stuff? What are some of the interesting psychological issues on this topic that you've explored and other people have explored?
Right. So critical thinking is one of them. Another way we think about that is we call it analytic thinking. It's the same sort of idea. But what that is like, are you willing to question your intuitions? And just a brief like background on what that means. Like an intuition is something that pops into your head automatically. So if I ask you what your name is, you don't need to think about the answer. It just pops into your head. That's the same thing as like seeing a news headline and becoming angry or scared. That you don't decide to do that. It just kind of happens to you. But you can also kind of stop and think, wait, well, is this actually true? And that extra kind of additional questioning process is just a very important critical element. And that's kind of the root of all critical thinking, essentially. So that's the one important thing. But there's lots of other elements that influence what people believe and share. You know, like just simply repeating something makes it seem more likely to be true, more plausible, and just because it's easier to process. And that's true even for the smartest people. It's true even for stuff that's like inconsistent with people's ideology. It's just a basic cognitive effect. And one thing, looking back at like differences between people, which is also important, one thing we've been doing recent work on is overconfidence, because that's something that kind of blocks you from thinking, from questioning whether you believe things. And that's not just overconfidence in a particular like, oh, I think this is really true. It's overconfidence like as a disposition. Are you someone who kind of inflates their own abilities? And that seems to block people from questioning things like conspiracy beliefs.
Yeah. So your work makes some interesting points about the difference between bias and rational reasoning when it comes to pre-existing false beliefs. I think a lot of people sort of conflate that a biased person is irrational or something like that. But you distinguish them. Can you describe this contrast?
Right. So a bias is something that is derived from experience. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. So like one way to think about it would be chess. Now, when you first are learning chess, you can't use your intuition at all because you don't really understand the game. You have to think a lot about it. But of course, you're not very good at the game at all. What you end up doing as you become really good at chess is you develop intuitions about what to do. That's essentially what knowledge is. You are training yourself to identify patterns very rapidly. And then like, you know, chess grandmasters can identify, you know, 50,000 different possible orientations of the board in like seconds. And that's all intuitions. That's the same process as what people typically refer to as bias.
Okay.
Rationality is just like, are you being accurate? And so like you can have a kind of intuition that is really rational. And so that's why we make this distinction. And in the context of, you know, misinformation, for example, a lot of the time, so people who are more analytic and deliberative, they actually often know, they have a better intuition about what's correct and incorrect, because they would have actually engaged with higher quality news content and informational content before they even entered the study. And so these things, they kind of feed into each other in that sort of way.
So when people swallow fake news, is that they're being irrational, or are they not bothering to use their rational faculties that they have?
Well, I mean, it's in a certain sense, it's kind of both. Like when we talk about irrationality, usually we hardly ever use the term, because what we really care about is what you said, unthinkingness. Are people, because that is, you can get it right for the wrong reasons, for example. What we want to know is, are people reasoning and thinking about things in a way that would lead to accuracy that's not by happenstance? So that's the kind of the key distinction there. We also, like, the other thing about the kind of rationality element is, like, we don't want to cast dispersions on people. So one way to think about it would be, if you were to grow up in a house that and only played like Fox News,
right?
Okay, and maybe you don't care about politics, and you're like a completely reasonable person and very rational, and you just like don't engage, but it's just on all the time. You're still going to be influenced by that. It's going to have an influence on what is plausible in the world to you, relative to someone who grew up in a house where MSNBC is on all the time. And so, if you look at, they would have a political bias in any kind of test. But that doesn't mean that they were engaging in any kind of irrational processing. It's just a feature of the information that they have received in the world. In the same way that you wouldn't blame Copernicus for getting it not exactly right. You know what I mean? So that we're a product of our environment, so we have to be careful about using these kind of terms.
Right. The new things you learned are not taken as on their own. It's you require more evidence if it doesn't fit in with what you already believed to be true, and that's generally a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And so you got this background knowledge that can influence whether you accept or reject new things coming in.
Yeah, exactly. To update in a Bayesian way, you need to take into account priors. That's prior knowledge. And like a great example of this that I like to give is the Daryl Bem classic precognition study in social psychology, which was, just for background, he was a researcher at Cornell who published a paper in a flagship journal of social psychology that made the claim that people have precognition. Essentially, they can essentially magically see into the future using methods that were typical at the time. And of course, now we know that like there's reasons why that was occurred, because it was p-hacked and selectively reported and all that kind of stuff. But what happened when that was published is that people were extremely skeptical of it.
Right.
But that was a completely rational response, because extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so it makes sense to be critical of things that don't make sense based on what we think we know about the world. Now, if what you're exposed to means what you think you know is not accurate, then you will end up in a place that is, you have inaccuracy, but that doesn't mean that you've engaged in an irrational process necessarily.
Right. And somebody who's lived their life believing in psychic abilities is going to see that, and it'll fit in better with what they already understand, and they won't be as critical of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So people talk about, you know, some people being gullible and some people more gullible than others. Is this actually a trait of people, or would you say that's an oversimplification?
Well, it's a simplification in some sense. It's a collection of traits. So, for example, one kind of key thing that we look at a lot is, we call it actively open-minded thinking. And that is the tendency to be willing kind of to question your beliefs according to evidence. Now, people who are higher in that are less gullible. They are more critical about the stuff that they see. And that's not like gullible in terms of, like, people often think about gullibility as just believing anything that other people tell you. This is more about like questioning yourself, but that leads to the same outcome essentially. But there are other traits. Like, some people are very agreeable. And so they will go along with what people say. In many cases, maybe they don't necessarily believe it, but that appears to people as being gullibility and will eventually kind of lead to some small differences in what they believe. And then there's some people who really trust their gut feelings, their intuitions. And that means that, like, it's easy for them if they come across something that's really compelling, maybe because it grabs their attention, or like it is consistent with what they've seen before or whatever, they're more likely to accept it. And that's another form of gullibility. So these are all kind of different mechanisms that produce similar outcomes, and they all kind of fall under the umbrella of gullibility.
Right, right. I think it's also like some matter of trusting people. If you know, the nice way to say that you're gullible is that you're trusting.
Yeah, exactly.
Assume people are giving you the straight.
Yeah, which in many context is highly adaptive. Like, you wouldn't talk. Right. I mean, kids are very, very gullible, but they have to be. Imagine,
yeah, you want them to be.
Imagine children.
They yeah, you want so them to listen to you.
Annoying, you know what I mean? So it's not. Yeah, it's people cast aspersions, but this is the same issue as we discussed before.
Yeah, my wife didn't grow up in a environment with a lot of sarcasm, so I could easily trick her for years. She's wised up as her priors have changed.
You've turned her into a cynic. That's too bad. But
yeah, made her a little more cynical. So you're a professor, so you do research, but you also teach classes. I was wondering, do you ever make an effort in your teaching to help students better understand how the information landscape and better and worse sources and thinking critically and that kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for asking that question, actually, because it's a big part of the job that I don't really get to discuss that much. But right now I'm teaching a class on misinformation. So like the course literally is about the topic that we're discussing, but it's spattered through all the courses that I teach.
Right.
So like I've taught courses on like introduction to organizational behavior, and a big part of the class is understanding decision making. You have to understand decision making to understand organizational behavior, and that comes down to thinking analytically and understanding what's true in the world, and that's all the same stuff that we've been talking about. Or I have other classes like on just general judgment decision making and things of that nature. But every class that I teach has the same sort of element, which is like, it's not the goal is not necessarily just to produce some set of facts that people remember, but to facilitate their improved ability to think analytically, which is kind of what the goal of education is. But I just happen to also be teaching them about research on how to think analytically, which makes it all very symmetric and hopefully straightforward. I don't know.
Right,
you can look online for my evaluations, I guess. But yeah,
that's great. You teach a whole class on it. So have you looked at historical trends with fake news and other misinformation?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because it's so hard to establish that. There's like a bunch of debating about this. For example, like in the context of conspiracies, some people have claimed, and it's kind of a lot of people generally think, that conspiracies are becoming more prevalent. Joel Yusinski,
conspiracy theories.
Yeah, theories, like okay.
not actual conspiracies.
Who knows, really? But
who
like,
knows about that? Right?
You know, who am I to say? But that is the extent to which people believe conspiracies is becoming more prevalent. Joel Yusinski is a researcher in Florida who has been making the argument that's not the case. That it's just kind of like there's a general level. I think actually he might be wrong, because like, at least in the States, like the election fraud conspiracy is a very, very prominent one.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't there before. But in any case, it's hard to establish, because we don't have like a baseline. We don't have like any way to measure essentially the quality of our collective information environment, because it's such a, you know, that's a very big thing to do. So we end up just kind of filling in with anecdotes, and it's kind of what's salient to us at the time. And so one thing I can say, I think with some confidence, is that we see bursts of misinformation and in cases where there's information gaps, like when an event, big event, you know, Russia invades Ukraine, Israel, Hamas, all these types of things, you see a big influx of misinformation in these kind of cases when an election happens. And so those are predictable, and we can just see it's going to happen before it happens, and it keeps on doing it. So
So you know, these with the recent creation of large language models, I've heard some talk about misinformation and disinformation being a larger problem, simply because people can create it so cheaply and at scale, and maybe even personalized for people. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about artificial intelligence, generative AI's role in misinformation?
Yeah, it's a problem. I mean, it already is easy to come up with BS, because it's a lot easier to do that than to, you know, come up with something that's true, because you're not constrained by reality. You can just make up things. And so without AI, we already have this kind of sort of issue. Now it can scale. Like there's like some element of like you have to keep on making things up, and there's a limit to how many different combinations of things you can make up, which the AI will be much better at doing. So that's definitely an issue. But there are some like reasons to think that we might be able to use AI to help combat misinformation too. In fact, we ran this recent experiment about conspiracy beliefs. We had believers come into the study. They indicated some sort of conspiracy that they thought was interesting and compelling. Mm-hmm. And then they had a conversation with ChatGPT about the conspiracy, where we had prompted the AI to kind of try to persuade them and give them evidence that was counter. to the conspiracy, you know, insofar as it's available, obviously, but in most cases it is. And people really, it really worked. People became less certain following the conversation. Like, it was, people found the arguments really compelling. And so, like, there's two sides of that coin. So,
yeah. I mean, you showed AI is persuasive. You happen to show it in a way that is beneficial.
Yeah.
But you also showed that it can be persuasive.
It's persuasive. It can be used for good and ill in the sense that, like, although, I mean, like, they do have some fail safes. Like, you can't, we wouldn't be able to get it to convince people to, like,
well, the ones run by big companies.
Yeah, exactly. That, or but yeah, exactly.
We
that,
have open source ones now. So
that's contingent on the goodwill of the people who create it. But the technology itself, you could actually. I mean, in a certain sense, it's, you know, kind of a scary prospect. But you know, we have to see what happens in the future.
Yeah. I mean, you say the people created it, but the people who control it, because the free ones now, the open source ones, can now be. They're out of the control of the people who created it.
Oh, really? You know? Okay.
Yeah, you can fine tune it to be whatever you want.
Okay.
And so, you know, well, it'll be interesting to see what people do with it for good and bad, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. So what does the future look like for this area of research? What do you plan on doing as your next steps, and what are you hoping the field will do? What are some of the big important, maybe unanswered questions? And
right. So, I mean, a lot of the recent work is on trying to use this underlying research on, like, the psychology of misinformation to inform interventions, ways to make things better. Okay, so, like, one example is we've done work showing that, consistent with the kind of thing I've been talking about, when people share misinformation online, they often don't even think about whether it's true. Like, they share it kind of reflexively. They and it had, like, they, because it's important or because other people will like it or whatever. And what we found is that, like, if you just simply remind people about accuracy, like, you don't tell them what to do, you just, like, ask them, hey, do you think accuracy is important? They'll share more accurate stuff. Like, it draws their attention to the idea. And so this is, like, a very simple kind of scalable intervention. And there's a bunch of other interventions out there. So, like, one thing is testing these things, but the other one is we're doing this large kind of mega study where we're testing all the interventions at once, like, in separate conditions, to see how they compare to each other with the same outcomes. Okay. And the results of that are basically, they're all the same. They all produce similar
effects.
No magic
bullet? Well, they all work, but there's no magic bullet.
Yeah. We already knew that. We knew that there's no magic bullet. And so, like, we just need to know how to combine these things and which things are most effective and which ones are least effective. Turns out they're all kind of equally effective, and we just need to use them, spatter in as many as we can to help make things better.
Are they all equally inexpensive?
No, they are not equally inexpensive.
Okay.
So that's, there's some, like, the one that
works. So there's a difference in bang for your buck.
Yeah, exactly.
But even if it's the same effect.
Exactly.
Right.
Which is a concern for the area, because a lot of the things are kind of these, someone has to sit down for 15 minutes and take a long kind of training course on digital literacy. Or you do something like I said, you kind of remind people to think about accuracy.
Yeah.
And those have similar effects on whether they're sharing misinformation. So that, you know, it's a cost effectiveness thing. But I mean, the whole idea there is to produce a toolbox for practitioners, for people who are actually in policy, to use to actually make things better.
Wow, that's great. Well, thanks for coming on. If people want to learn more about your work, what do you recommend?
I have a website, gordonpennycook.com. They can check that
out. gordonpennycook.com. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on to Minding the Brain.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. If you want to connect with Minding the Brain on social media, you can find us on Instagram at Minding the Brain. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.